My name is Cricket, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
My sobriety date is October the 19th of 1969. And I've done... Thank you. I've done one thing right since I came in the fellowship of AA, and I haven't taken a drink of alcohol. That's the only thing I've done consistently right since that day. I was born into a family that society called illiterate people, and I listened to Wilma last night talking about the large family she came from, and I did too. I didn't know my natural father, unfortunately. I have two knowledges of him that were told to me, but from information told to me. The man fired 17 children that we know of, and he left a lot, so I know he was potent and knew how to pack. And that's the only accurate information I have about my natural father. My mother's a full-blooded, short, black Irish female that comes, her whole family comes over from Ireland with a lot of superstitions that are real true for them. They affect generation after generation. My mother was very, very fortunate when my father left that she married a gentleman with a third grade education that cared enough about her and her children to want to support him. The only way he could support us was for us to follow crops all over the United States, and that's what we did. And I loved following crops. There was only one thing about following crops I didn't like. We started new schools. It usually doesn't depend on vegetables and fruits where you attend school at. With crop followers, it does. I liked the way of life. I liked not knowing where we were going to be next, not knowing what we were going to do next. The only thing I didn't like is that every time I started a new school, I felt like I was too tall. Full grown, I'm 5'3". I must have really been in some school that year. I felt like I was too short. I felt like I was too fat. I felt like I was too skinny. There was always something wrong with the outside of Cricket that prevented me from fitting in with the other children and the other little girls. I always wanted to be able to invite other kids to our home, but people were afraid of us. We called ourselves crop followers. The sharecroppers called us crop followers. Society called us gypsies, you know? And they were afraid we'd steal their children. I guarantee we didn't want any kids, you know? Money? Yeah. Jewelry? Yeah. Kids? No. Your kids were safe. We'd leave them, and some of ours. It was a real strange type of existence, not from within us, but from without us. It was real strange because we were shut in a culture literally that eliminated outside people. It eliminated being a part of school activities. It eliminated being a part of church activities. We went to church real regular. We went twice a year. We went at Thanksgiving, and we went at Christmas, and we went for the right reasons. At Thanksgiving and Christmas, Christians are told you must share with the poor people. Now, from January till November, they forget to remind them. But at Thanksgiving and Christmas, they fix big wicker baskets of fruit and vegetables, perhaps a turkey, and they give it to you on one condition: you had to be poor. So that was kind of a insulting, qualifying membership, and we'd have to go and listen to a minister. And as a young child, when we do those things and we go to that church, and I'd sit out there and I'd sit in the back row, and a gentleman would stand behind the podium and he'd share. And he was sharing the truth as he knew it. And he was even sharing the truth as it may actually be. He said, if you want to be a new creature, you must be born again. He said, anything you pray for in the name of Jesus, you will receive it. That may be true. He didn't know what the little crop follower heard. I was dirty. We didn't have indoor plumbing or electricity. And I had real ugly skin. And I had long, dark, stringy, filthy, dirty hair. And my teeth were already beginning to rotten out of my mouth. And so when he said that to me, I naturally went to the altar because I did want to be a new creature. I already knew that if I had blonde hair and brown eyes, I'd be okay. So I thought if I went to the altar, I'd have blonde hair and brown eyes, and I'd be okay. Because that's what this kid heard. That's what the little girl cricket heard the gentleman say. That's not what the man meant. I went home and I stood in front of our mirrors. We used the bottoms of tin cans for mirrors. You could shine them up. And they worked real well. And I put my finger on a place where there was not a zit. And I said, in the name of Jesus, when I get up in the morning, make the rest of my face as clear as this spot right here. And I really believed in my childhood innocence that because this adult said that behind the podium, because he was talking about a man named Jesus, and because they fed poor people twice a year, that I would wake up with real clear skin. And I went to bed, and I got up in the morning, and I ran to the mirror, and there was a pimple right where I prayed. So, see, I knew Jesus didn't like me. I didn't want anything to do with Jesus anymore. Because Jesus didn't really do what he said he was going to do. And this Christian man lied to me. That meant Christianity wasn't true. It's not what it really meant, but that's what it meant to me then. We followed crops until I was about 12, and my stepfather contracted rheumatoid arthritis from working in the field. We could no longer pick crops, so we settled in Denver, Colorado. We hadn't been there very long, and the city of Denver and the state of Colorado stepped in, and they told me they were going to send me to a reform school. Two of my brothers, my older brothers, had become armed robbers, and I had found a hiding place. And my hiding place was behind the old wood stove. That was what we cooked on. That was what we heated the home with. That was it. It was the one place in my childhood where I was safe. We had the type of family that when the sun goes down, it gets real dark outside, and children come running in from play, and they say, Mama, Mama, I'm home. In our family, you ran outside when it got dark because you didn't know what was out there, but you knew what was inside the house. And I'd hide behind the old wood stove, and I felt safe, and I felt secure. And I'd close my eyes and I'd pretend. And I'd pretend that I was Roy Rogers and Dale Evans' daughter. And I'd pretend that I had blonde hair and brown eyes. And I pretended that something was different on the outside of cricket. Because inside of cricket, there was always a storm. Inside of cricket, there was always a lot of noise. Inside of cricket, there was always a hunger that couldn't be filled no matter what I did. When my brothers chose their profession, they also chose their hiding place. And it was behind my wood stove. That's where they hid their guns and their money. I didn't want that. You know, I felt violated one more time. You know, this is my place. This is where, the only place in the whole wide world that I can go alone. This is the only place where I'm safe. And they took my hiding place. Excuse me. They told me if I didn't tell on them that they'd give me something to drink that would make me feel real good. And they introduced me to what became my very favorite relative, Jim Beam. He became my uncle. And we practiced a lot of years together. And I took the lid off of that bottle and I drank it. And I didn't drink like a lady. I just guzzled the whole thing and it burned. It burned all the way down. It burned my throat, my stomach, my fingertips. It burned all the way back up again. And all the way back down again, and I kept drinking it. And what happened was, I didn't have to imagine anymore. I didn't have to pretend that I had blonde hair and brown eyes. I prayed what was going to be for many years my final prayer. And it was, Dear God, Sir, if you are, I have one request from you. I don't want to ever feel again. Because see, I don't believe in family. I know what that's all about. I don't believe in goodness because it doesn't exist. I don't believe in any of those things that people tell you. So just don't let me feel again. And just so you know, I'm not being one-sided in this deal, sir. I don't even want to feel good. Just don't let me feel anything. And I did. With the help of alcohol, I didn't have to feel very many things for the next many, many years. As a result of my brother introducing me to alcohol, I left home within about 2 days from my first drink, and I started living on the streets of Denver. That's when the state interfered and said that they were going to send me to the Colorado State Girls Reform School to punish me for being incorrigible. And I didn't know what the word meant. It meant that I was 12 years old and no adult could handle me. And I thought, wow, I like those kind of 12-year-olds. But, you know, they turned me on. Because in a 12-year-old that no adult can handle is saying, quiet the storms, fill in the gaps, put an answer to that question mark in my spirit. That's all a 12-year-old that you can't handle is asking. Bond with me, hold me, close me, clothe me. Let me come in when it's nighttime. Tell me why. Don't quit loving me. That's all a 12-year-old wanted to know. This 12-year-old, and I haven't met one since, that doesn't want to know the same thing. They sent me to this reform school in Morrison, Colorado, and I walked in, and they had matrons and everything, and they walked me around to show me the dormitories, and they showed me to this room, and it had one little bed in it, and I thought, my God, that's going to be crowded. And they said, this is your room. This is your bed. And I thought, well, where's the others? I'd never slept one person to a bed in my entire life. And they said, just you. I thought, geez, man, punish me. Come on. They took me to another room, and it had a thing that sat in there, and you sit down on it, and you go to the bathroom, and you flush it. And I thought, wow. There wasn't a galvanized tub in the middle of the kitchen floor once a week. And I liked being punished. I stayed there for 12 months. In the reform school, I learned to walk an edge. The year after I got sober, the same lady that ran the Colorado State Reform School was convicted of selling the girls for prostitution from the day she opened it. But those are things society doesn't believe because you're bad little girls. You're bad little girls. So it took them, I was 12 and she got caught when I was 28. A lot of little crickets walked through that door. A lot of them. But people don't believe you because you're bad. When I left the state reform school, I went back to my mama's home and I did what girls do when they go home. I don't know what family life is about, I'm learning. I knocked on her door and I went in and I said, Mama, I'm home. And she said, yep, I know. See, I want her to stand up and say, I'm glad. I want her to say, I've missed you. I haven't seen you in a year. I've missed you. And I looked at her and I said, Mom, I can't stay. She said, yep, I know. I want her to say, you can't go. But she couldn't or wouldn't. I'm not as magnanimous as a lot of members of AA. I can't say she couldn't. She just didn't want to. When I left her house that day, I stayed on the streets of Denver for about 3 or 4 more years. And I did whatever a young alcoholic female had to do to get that next drink. I was about 16 years of age, and the state of Colorado stepped in once again. And they told me they were going to send me to the Colorado State Insane Asylum in Pueblo, Colorado, and I thought, oh, my God. They didn't have anything called alcoholism for teenagers back then. They didn't recognize it. So they told me that they were sending me there because I was schizophrenic, with paranoid reactions, with psychotic tendencies. And once again, I didn't know, I was sober and had the most wonderful sponsor in the world with 8 years of sobriety before I found out that schizophrenic meant I was two-faced, and I am, that paranoid meant I thought you talked about me behind my back, and you do, and that psychotic meant I'd rather kill you than me, and I would, you know? They put me in a state insane asylum for being normal. I think that's real good, sound mental health, you know. I really believe that if someone in this room chooses to drink today, I'd rather it be one of you than me. I'm real selfish about my life and my sobriety. When I went to the state of Colorado, the insane asylum in Pueblo, Pueblo's a coal town. And this is a real old nut house. It's not a treatment center. It's not a hospital. I don't know what it is today. Back then, it was an insane asylum. When I walked in the door, there was a room about this large. And there were about this many people. So you really need to think about where you're at. Because when I walked in that room, it was the first fear that I've known since I was 4 years of age. And it was a fear that permeated the air. And it was a fear that crept through the pores of my skin, clear down into the pores of my soul. And it was a fear that just saturated my being, and I couldn't define it. There was an odor in the air that I've never smelled before nor since. And it's not the odor of you think about it like in a nursing home. It's an odor of hopelessness. It's an odor of total giving up, not surrender, giving up. An odor of spiritual decay. They decided when I was at the Colorado State Insane Asylum, and I heard Camille talk this morning, I thought kind of funny. She said, take a nut, and I thought, here's one. Give them shock treatments. They did. given Thorazine, they did. For 18 months, they gave me Valium, Librium, and Thorazine four times a day, about a total of 200 milligrams of each, to all told, four times a day. I was one of the original guinea pigs for electric shock treatments. It was before they gave you sodium pentothal. It was when they still sometimes had to medically resuscitate you because your heart quit beating. And they told me they was going to do this to make me okay, to make me forget what it was that caused me to be what I was. And they laid me on a gurney, and they put a great big wad of gauze in my mouth, and this doctor's psychiatrist, well-educated people, were experimenting with the electric shock. And they had people holding my body down on both sides. And they had this gauze in my mouth, and they grabbed my chin and tilt it back, and the psychiatrist would look down at me, and he'd say, "Are you scared?" And I thought, "Buddy, you're the shrink, and I've got enough sense not to ask anybody a question with a roll of gauze in their mouth and people holding down every part of their body. How can I respond?" And yes, my friend, I'm scared. For three times a week for 18 months, I got electric shock treatment. They terrified me. I was as scared of my last one as I was my first one. When that man would reach his hand up to that lever, I knew what would happen because they went alphabetical, and my maiden name starts with a V. And you sit in a waiting room while people got their treatment, and you'd see them come out of there, and their chin would be hitting their chest, and their shoulders would be slumped, and they'd be going, and there'd be a big wet spot where they'd lost bodily control. Yes, my friend, I'm scared. After 18 months, they decided to release me from the Colorado State Insane Asylum on a temporary release, lifetime, which in a way is injustice, and in a way it's justice, I guess. What it means is that I can't vote. I have to have special permission to have driver's license. I can't serve on a jury. Some of those legal things I can't do that I'd probably be real, real good at because I have a real fair mind. The unfair part is that it also means the law cannot punish me no matter what I do because I'm a mental patient. And it's kind of, you know, it used to be kind of exciting because I knew I could kill people and get away with it. Because I'm a nut. I have papers that say I can commit murder and society might make me do 180 days. And then I answer their questions right and they let me walk the streets again, like Camille was saying. See, that's really not a freedom. What that is an abhorrent lack of responsibility. It took away any right I had to start accepting responsibility. It gave me total freedom with no control. No control. I've tried my backyard both ways. I have a child. And I've tried it both ways. I've tried it without a fence, and I've tried it with a fence. And without a fence, my little girl, when she was a child, would only go so far, and then she'd kind of back off in fear because she didn't know how far she was allowed to go. With the fence around her, she knew her boundaries, and she never tried to go any further. That's what I needed. I needed the boundaries. I didn't need the total unfenced what society gave me. Do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. The 18 months that I was in the state insane asylum, I did not take a drink. I'm sure it had something to do with the Valium, Librium, and Thorazine. When I was released from the Colorado State Insane Asylum, I weighed close to 200 pounds. I could not walk out into the sun because of the effects of Thorazine. I could hardly speak because of the effects of the electric shock treatment. And we used to have a thing around Alcoholics Anonymous called Jake Leg. You know, every now and then you'd see some good old buzzer that had gotten Jake Leg from drinking. And he just kind of drug it behind him. And I was one of those. And it was kind of neat, in a way, because my outside spoke what my inside had become, a nothing. I got on the Greyhound bus in Pueblo and went back to my mother's home, and it was a replay. I wasn't quite 18 years of age. I told her, "Mama, this time I'm not coming back." She said, "Yep, I know." "Mom, I'm never coming home." The ultimate threat to the parent. She said, "Yep, I know." And so I left. And I took the Greyhound bus, and the Greyhound bus and my whiskey and I became the very best of friends for the next 10 years of life. I didn't care where I went, who I went with, how I got there. Never had a desire to stop drinking or change my lifestyle. just did not care, did not feel my prayer was answered. I walked through life that way. I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard a lot of men when I first came into AA talk about the women they met in beer joints, how if you put a sack over their head, they were all the same. So are you boys. You know, the main difference is us women could always do it. And it was kind of neat. You know, I had to come to AA for a man to insult me about my abilities and his abilities. I liked beer joints. That's where I like to drink at. And I always found my neighborhood beer joint in my bar stool. My last year of drinking was from East Colfax to West Colfax. It's a straight shot all the way through Denver. No desire to ever stop. I was sitting in the Green Beret, or the Red Beret, on West Colfax one evening, and a man and his wife came in. And he said, so I walked over to him, and I thought he was going to play the little boy game that a lot of drunks do in beer joints. I love Al-Anons. They stay home, and their husbands come into beer joints, and then they go home, they tell their wives, you know, it's really not my fault. This little gal hustled up on me, and we really didn't do anything. And usually they didn't. They're telling you the truth. But you sit down next to your alcoholics in a beer joint, and they sit there and they say, God, I've had a rough day. And you look up at them and you say, what's the matter? Well, I work all day long, take care of the wife and kids, and go home, and all she does is bitch at me. And you look at that alcoholic drunk on that bar stool next to you, and you say, God, if I had a man like you. And that alcoholic's ego just goes out to here, and you start thinking, sucker. And he buys you. You know, and he continues to buy you drinks, and his Al-Anon wife at home crying about who he's out with. Really, you should be real proud of him. You know, he wasn't out getting anything you'd want him to have. Nothing that was a threat in any way. They buy you a drink, and that's all you cared about. This guy was trying to, I was trying to hustle him out of a drink. His name is Harry. He lived in Denver at the time. I don't know if he still does or not. He says, Cricket, I think you need to think about maybe joining a fellowship. I think you've got a problem with alcohol. I never had a problem with alcohol. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, I'd like to see you go to a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, I don't need that. And he said, if you're not afraid to try, I'd like to see you go to 1311 York Street tomorrow night. It's an AA group. They teach people about alcoholism, about how to stay sober. Well, I didn't want to stay sober. Didn't want to know anything about alcoholism. I was okay. People could call me a drunk. That didn't bother me. Don't call me inebriated or you'd have a fight on your hand, because I didn't know what the word meant. And I told him, okay, I'll go to your thing tomorrow night. He said, now don't take a drink in the morning. I said, listen, big boy, I can quit drinking anytime I want to. And he said, okay, get up in the morning, don't take a drink, and we'll come and get you for a meeting tomorrow night. I said, okay, no problem. And I lived over on Wolf Street in Denver. And I woke up the next morning, and I did what I'd done for many a year. Scraped the puke out of my eyebrow, reached for a drink, and I didn't take it. And I got up, and I went to the bathroom, and I quelled all those feelings, and I still did not take that first drink. He called that afternoon. He said, Cricket, did you take that drink? I said, no, big boy, I told you I wouldn't. He said, you need a ride to the meeting? I said, no. Don't need anything from you, okay? I told you I'd be there, I'll be there. It was snowing and everything, and I called a yellow cab to come and get me. The yellow cab came and got me, and I said, I need to go to 1311 York Street. And he said, okay. And the closer he got, one of the few feelings I'd had in many years started coming up. I thought, Alcoholics Anonymous. I can figure out what alcoholic means. Anonymous sounds real close to KKK. And being a cult follower's daughter, you really don't know prejudice. And I was kind of afraid of walking in and seeing people dressed in white sheets with double A's on their chest going, you know. I found out we've got some groups where they do that now. But I choose not to join them. I went to my first meeting, but I didn't let the cab driver drop me off there. I said, sir, I made a mistake. This is the address I need. I didn't want him to see me walk up those steps into that big red building. Didn't want him to know that's where I was going. For some reason, I felt embarrassed. The week before, I'd been hauled to the Denver jail in the back of a paddy wagon, and I waved out people at the back window. That didn't embarrass me. Alcoholics Anonymous did. But see, I knew I was going to get out of jail. They couldn't keep me. I didn't know what y'all were going to do. When the taxi turned the corner and left, I walked from that apartment over to York Street Group, and I climbed those stairs, and I walked into my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I didn't see anything I wanted. Nothing. Didn't hear anything I wanted to hear. There was a woman there. Her name was Sharon. She walked up to me, bounced up to me, whatever you want to call it, and she said, "Hi, my name's Sherry. Are you an Alkie?" And I knocked her on her rear end. I didn't like her. You know, I didn't like her. She came behind my wood stove. She was trying to get behind my wood stove. I didn't ask her who she was. I didn't care. And she had no right to ask me who I was. And I sat on the back row and I listened to these people. This, in about a 3-day period, I got almost kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got regulated, let's put it that way. I sit on the back row and they have these brown wicker baskets. And when I was fresh to sobriety, they used to say, if you've got it, put it in. If you need it, take it out. After my second meeting, they quit saying that. They used to say, take what you can use now. What you can't use now, come back and get later. I took their adding machine, their typewriter. And there's an organization within the organization called Bleeding Deacons. It's a group of men. I guess they meet in clothes closets somewhere because no one's ever introduced me. I don't know. The treasurer might come real close. They told me it depends on how I do, whether I get my expenses paid or not. These group of men came up to me and they said, "Cricket, I had almost 3 days. We're not going to put up with your stuff anymore." And I thought, hey, I haven't been here long enough to show it to you. You're not the most important person here. I thought, who said I was? You're the ones who said all the stuff, not me. He said, there's other people here who are trying to stay sober one day at a time. So we've got a little deal for you. They had read me these questions. You know, they had this lady reading me these questions. She had a couple of men sit with her while she did because of what happened with Sharon and I. And she read me these questions. Has alcoholism ever affected your job? Nuh-uh. I never worked a legal job. You know, alcoholism was great for my career. But it got down to that question of, has alcoholism ever affected your sex life? And I looked around the room and started seeing some things that I might want out of your fellowship. And I said, write no out there with my phone number to the side. Because one of those things looks pretty good. And she did. And I panhandled. And they told me that I couldn't do that anymore. That they could not kick me out of AA. And I wanted them to. I wanted them to kick me out of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because society had already said I was not responsible. I didn't want to be responsible. And Harry was telling me, I've introduced you to a solution to your lifestyle. Whether or not you accept it is your responsibility. If they kicked me out, then I didn't have that responsibility. I'd heard the two-drink theory. You know, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. So I already planned on going back to the Red Beret. And I was going to order 2 drinks and have them set them on right in front of my bar stool. And I was going to pour the first drink out and drink the second drink and call AA and say, you lied. It's the second drink that got me drunk. I poured the first one out. At that time, that made sense. It was real valid and it made common sense to me. It doesn't today, but it did then. This group of men told me that I had to return all the money I'd stolen. I had to bring back the adding machine and the typewriter. I had to repair the coin box on the Coke machine. I had to take my phone number back from all the married men. And I could not walk in the doors of their building unescorted. 2 men would meet me at the door in time for the 8 o'clock meeting. 2 men would walk me upstairs to the meeting and sit on each side of me until the meeting was over. And I was going on 3 days of continuous sobriety. Had no choice, had to let them do that. Couldn't drink because they didn't tell me I was kicked out. My 3rd day of sobriety at York Street, I went into convulsions, went into DTs. And like Camille was saying, there weren't treatment centers per se back then. And they held me down.
for 72 hours. They worked with me. We did the old orange juice and honey routine. We did the cleaning up after cricket. And thank God I've had the opportunity to do that for others since that point. I weighed 70 pounds when I came into AA. My teeth had literally rotted out of my head, and I had hair that hung down to my waist. And I smelled equally as bad as I looked. And my language was street language because it was all I knew. I stayed in Denver and sober for 6 months. And the narcotics division of the Denver Police Force came to this place I was staying at and said I had to leave town. I'd been kicked out of both Kansas cities and knew why. I could not understand it with 6 months sobriety why I was being kicked out of Denver. They told me because they felt like it would be better for my life if I left Denver, and I said, okay, where am I going? And they said, you're going to Fort Worth, Texas. And I just kind of sucked wind, and I said, wait a minute, boys. You don't understand. Drunk, I knew better than to go to Texas. And sober, you're sending me down there. This is a kid that used magazine pages, and you're sending me where they recommend corn cobs? No, thank you. I don't want to go. And they told me I had no choice, and so I had to pull the tough little cricket routine. I said, I'll go on three conditions, big boys. And they said, what's that? I said, I want a car with a driver's license, and I had never driven. I want a GED, and I have a fourth grade education. And I want three cases of the softest toilet paper made by mankind. That's the only way you'll get me down there with those goat ropers and everything that goes on in Texas. I'd heard about them. I knew why they were the last state to join. My husband's a natural native born bred Texas, and it just kind of, you know, our concepts are totally different. And when I got those things going, and they bought me the toilet paper, and they bought me a car, and they took me to a building, and a lady read me a bunch of questions and told me I'd passed my GED, and then they headed me towards Fort Worth. And they told me to go by Lake Whitney and meet Bob W. And I thought, okay. And I did exactly what they told me to do. I drove from Denver to Lake Whitney, and that's really not how you have to go to get to Fort Worth. And I drove up in front of this little real estate office, and this big old white-haired man walked out, and he said, hi, I'm Bob W. And I said, who gives up? He said, you must be Cricket. I said, yeah, I am. And he said, is there anything I can do for you? I said, no, sir. Nothing I want from you. Just want to go to Fort Worth. All I want to do. I want to live until I die. That's it. Period. No desires, no goals. Then I went into Fort Worth, and I did what I was supposed to do next. I called the nearest AA group. And it was a replay of York Street. If I didn't like your discussion, I turned the tables over. I never asked you to change the topic. I would not. I would just get up and turn your table over on you. They replaced all the tables at one group in Fort Worth, changed them from glass top to wood. And it was okay. You know, it was okay. I didn't know how to do any different. I did the one thing right. I didn't take a drink. Then I met a lady by the name of Betty G after several years of continuous sobriety. And this lady took me, and she told me, she said, Cricket, I'm going to be your sponsor. I said, lady, who asked? She said, nobody. But I'm going to teach you how to live. I said, lady, I've been sober 7-8 years. She said, yeah, that's the only thing you've done right. I said, but I'm fine. Right, Camille? And she said, I know. This lady was a judge's daughter. She'd had the finest education, master's degree, well-educated, a lady, alcoholic, sober, many, many years. And she took me over to her apartment. First of all, she took me in the office at Harbor Group. She pulled out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she handed it to me, and she opened it up, and she said, read me the first portion of Chapter 5. And I did. I read, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And I read on and on. And Betty reached over, and she shut the book. And she said, Cricket, you can't read. I said, lady, I just read that sucker to you. She said, no, darling, it was on Chapter 3. You're an AA parrot. You're repeating verbatim what you've heard people say over and over and over, and you've got it memorized. what I'm going to do with you now is I'm going to take you to TCU, that's Texas Christian University. I thought, hot diggity, from fourth grade to TCU, that's class. And she did. And she took me to a thing called remedial reading. And the teacher was in her 70s. And the next youngest student to me was 10 years of age. And I went. And I went day after day after day. And I looked at their little TV screen. And one day I looked at that TV screen, and all those letters of a word joined hands. You know, it's something that may not mean anything to anyone in this room but me, but when you take a B and an A and a T, and you don't know what that is, and this lady puts that together for you, and she says it's the, and you say, that. And these little kids around you start clapping and cheering, and the word is yours, and it's yours here, and you know what it is? Man, the big book became mine. Up until that point, you were the only example of this program that I knew. And did you ever fall short? Yes, my friend. Do I ever fall short? Yes, my friend. That book became my friend. My sponsor told me, I'm going to teach you to dress like a lady. Because I dressed like a tramp. Hated Al-Anon. Hated them. Because alcoholics told me they're sicker than we are. The Al-Anons never told me that. Just the alcoholics. And so I did the Al-Anon group and at my home group a favor. I went to one of the local hospitals and asked where the intensive care unit was, and they told me. And so I stole the sign off of it and hung it on the Al-Anon room door. I didn't win any friends in our local Al-Anon group. Didn't know why. Only in AA have I heard that we're more intelligent than other people. You know, and the only people, I've never had an Al-Anon tell me that. Just another grub. You know, we're just, our problem is we're more intelligent than the normal man. Says who? You know, another grub. My IQ test is no sharper than anybody else's, you know? It really isn't. I've got the ability to learn, thank God. Thank God I have the ability to learn. When I was able to open up with my sponsor's help, she said, you have no moral standards. You've never been taught right from wrong. And I'm going to teach you. And it's all here in this book, and I thought it's going to have to be, have some sequels to it to teach me anything about morals, lady. And she said, no, it's all right here. That much reading. Your whole moral standards the rest of your life are going to be based on just a few questions. Is it selfish? Will it cause jealousy? Will somebody get hurt? Do you know what happens if I try to dress very seductively and there's a new Al-Anon with a new AA man in the room and I go up and I lean on him and I turn my back to her? Does somebody get hurt? Yeah. Does it cause jealousy? Yeah. Do I have the right? No. You know, my moral standards won't let me. My moral standards won't let me. They're real simple, three of them. Do you know how people feel when you steal their jewelry? When you cut the tires on their car? When you burn their house down? I can't do those things anymore. And I've done them all before. I didn't get little resentments at people. If I didn't like you, I burned your house down. I cut your tires. I did those kind of things. I was a real sick individual. Still am in a lot of ways. Betty told me that she was going to teach me how to eat properly. Ours was first come, first served. We didn't have a family table spread. You know, and you eat like animals. When you have to dig in garbage barrels and scrape maggots off a cantaloupe to have a bite to eat, you eat like animals. She told me I couldn't do that anymore. She told me I had to learn to do things with the proper amount of decorum and good manners. She said, you don't have to love everybody in AA, and I'm real glad she said that, because I sure don't. She said, you don't even have to like everybody in AA. And I'm real glad she said that, because I sure don't. But you know what? I have to care enough that if you're hungry, I'll feed you. If you're naked, I'll clothe you. And if you want to take that first drink, I'll do anything in my power to help you not to take that first drink. I don't know what quality sobriety is. I really don't. I don't try to judge another's sobriety. I don't know how. I know that I sat on the back row this morning And I saw a little boy with eyeglasses on, about 4 years of age, and he kept peeking back at me. And I thought, man, that little boy, baby, has no idea what he's doing. That little boy has no idea of the violent, ugly woman that used to would have reached across and knocked him out of his chair for looking at me with a doubled up fist. So you know what I did? I tested God's water. I tested it. The little boy put his hand on the chrome on the back of the chair. And my hand shook, but I reached up and I rubbed the top of his hand. I wanted to know if it was okay. You know, is it okay? I like kids. I like little kids. Because if I don't force them, they don't force me. And that's a freedom. My sponsor took me to step one in this fellowship. And she told me, remember, that sobriety is as progressive as alcoholism. And you don't have the steps without the tradition. They go hand in hand. It's a two-way journey, and you've got to be able to abide by both. Or someday, there's going to be a cricket coming through that door, and the door is going to be barred because of lack of principle, because of doing things the way we're not supposed to do them. Can our fellowship be destroyed? Yeah, it really can. It can be destroyed by people like me. I could go and break my anonymity on a public level. I could violate the 12 traditions. I was telling, we've got Scott and Sheila as our host and hostess, and they're wonderful and delightful. I think the word suggestive should be stricken from our traditions. I think they ought to be mandatory. Sobriety could be suggested, but not our traditions. You know, there's something there that we get on real shaky eyes. We take for granted that we're going to walk in that door and there's going to be somebody there. And there may be. There's a group in Fort Worth that if you take two people out of it, the most sobriety you're going to have is maybe a year. You know, I'm sorry. Newcomers are as important to me as people with 43 years. But the newcomer needs to be taught right away that the person with 43 years has already been through most of the things they're going to go through. And it's a chain link deal, my friend. And it's a chain link from that newcomer up to the one with the longest term sobriety. And if we don't do it, if my hand's not down there to the newcomer, and my hand's not up here to the person with more sobriety than me, my chain's broken. And I'm the only one that can break that chain. I'm the only one that can violate either end of it. As long as my hand is open on both ends, whether you choose to take it or not, I don't care. You know, I hope and pray to God that I'm never sober long enough that I can't dump ashtrays in an AA meeting hall. I did it this morning. This is a pretty big meeting hall. I hope I'm never sober long enough that I can't take a new female and clean her up when she's sick. I do that on as regular a basis as I care to. I never knew when I got this sponsor where my life was going to go. This lady took me, and she taught me everything I know. And I went to her home, and she became very ill. And I got to where I'd go by her home every morning and do her breakfast and go by at lunch and go by at dinner. And she'd walked me this journey. And I didn't know what I was going to do because I knew she was dying. And she knew she was dying. And I went by one evening, part of my making amends, because I used to steal old age pension checks out of the mail. And there's really no way to make amends to that because you don't write down names. I had to call Bingo for Harbor Group of Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years to make amends to senior citizens. And I paid that price. I did that. What my sponsor told me to, I did it. Don't get a sponsor unless you do what they tell you. If you don't want to do what they tell you, get somebody else. Don't waste their time. This particular night I went to get by and I took Betty G, and it was Valentine's Day about 3 or 4 years ago. Tucked her in bed and gave her 6 yellow tulips and put her in the lavender nightgown. And I said, I'm going to go call Betty G. And she looked up at me. She said, Cricket, you know I love you. And I looked down at her, and for the first time, I said, Betty G, I love you too. And I went down and I called Bingo, and I went over the next morning to fix my sponsor's breakfast. She didn't answer my call when I unlocked her front door. And I thought, well, I'll go in and fix her pain and get her cereal ready. But instead, I went upstairs. My sponsor's lying in her bathroom floor dead. You know, I should have found her. It should have been my gift to be with her. I should have tucked her in that last night, and I got to. And I found my sponsor, and I knelt down beside her. And rigor mortis had already set in. She was real stiff. And I covered her up, and I put my arm around her, and I said, "Betty, how can I give it back? You know, I've got a daughter that wouldn't be alive if it hadn't been for my sponsor because of the violent side of cricket. How can I give this back? You know, she's gone, and I don't have anybody. See, I didn't date. I didn't want an AA relationship. My first 2 years of sobriety is almost a blackout, whiteout, grayout. It's just not there. How can I repay this lady? This lady taught me how to live, how to breathe in and out, how to hold a cup of coffee, how to say please and thank you. She taught me how to allow you to live." And she was gone. Just overnight. And when I tucked her in that night, I didn't expect that. And I called the ambulance because that's what they told me to do. And when they came, they told me I had to leave. And I said, "But I have a right." And they said, "No, you've got to leave while we take her outside." I said, "But you don't need to take her in the ambulance." "Well, you did." And they said, "Yes, but because of the condition she fell in, some of the sounds we have to make will be very startling and offensive." And so I went outside. And when they came out with her on the stretcher, I walked her to that journey. And I was able to hold her hand. I couldn't hold it while she was alive. You know, I couldn't say thanks to Betty Jean while she was alive. I couldn't. I didn't know how. Because that was coming all the way from behind my wood stove. That was all, giving too much of cricket. That was saying, "Okay, I give up. I surrender totally and completely." And God, as I understand Him, allowed me to do everything the lady asked me to do while she was living. Get up in the morning, clean up, dress appropriate, go to the job that you're qualified to do, and believe in the promises of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they will come true for you. Keep your moral standards the way they should be, and God will bring you joy and peace. And about a year ago, I got married to a wonderful man. That's in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got a marriage that's like any other marriage, except this. We've got a marriage that's bound by the love of God, you know, and that love of God stems from the love of a sponsor. We've got a marriage that can include a child not conceived by Him, that can introduce me to a best friend named Mark, that we can drive to Omaha when people want us to be here, that we can accept that as an honor and a privilege, because that's what it is. See, you don't have to hear any of the speakers. You maybe not don't need us, but we really need you. Because if you keep suiting up and showing up, then those things on the wall are going to keep hanging up, and then someone's going to keep being here, and you're going to be able to show them. Walk the walk. If someone acts like they're not doing the deal, don't judge them. Maybe they can't read. Ask them. Walk with them. Feed them if they're hungry. Clothe them if they're naked. Care about them because they don't know how to care about themselves. What can I thank you for? Sobriety? Without question. Life? Without question. Sanity? Without question. And because you were able to give that to me, I'm able to be a mother. A mother. You know, this is a woman that they locked up for beating children. Don't hurt kids. Don't hurt him. This is a woman that set her house on fire with her entire family locked inside so none of them could escape. And the fire department ruined it for me. I won't do that today. This is a woman who did not know how to earn an honest dollar. And I guarantee you, I don't know how not to today. This is a woman who knows how to have the maturity to make the commitment to one man. One man. And know that that's a God-blessed deal. A God-honored deal. This is a woman who needs you as much today as she did October the 19th of 1969. I need to walk with you one more mile because I don't know when it's going to be your last. And I don't know when it's going to be my last. For what I am, I thank you. And for what I hope to be, thank you.